Well, now, I wonder how many of you like board games and how many of you like reading. For those of you who are into both, we used to have a board game called Ex Libris, where you were given the name of a famous novel, and then you had to guess several alternative first lines to that novel. The idea was that you had to guess which was the real first line and which were fakes written by the other players in the game. It's a good fun game, actually, if you come across it. Authors put a huge amount of time and effort into the start of their books because it's those first lines that will capture the interest and imagination of their readers or lose them before they get started. So, for example, we have lines like, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife." Anyone know where that comes from? Pride and Prejudice, I heard somebody say. Very good. "It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair." Tale of Two Cities, very good. You all know that one, Charles Dickens. Maybe a little bit less known, but you might guess it. There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. Anyone know? Voyage of the Dawn Treader, very good, C.S. Lewis. Last one. You might or might not know the book, but the author will be no surprise. "Into the face of the young man who sat on the terrace of the Hotel Magnifique at Cannes, there had crept a look of furtive shame, the shifty hangdog look which announces that an Englishman is about to talk French." I'll tell you, it was The Luck of the Bodkins by P.G. Wodehouse. Instantly, you're engaged, you're intrigued, you want to know more. Now, if you were going to give an award for the best starting lines in a book in the Bible, I'm guessing that a lot of people would vote for John's start to his gospel. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." You hear that and you think, wow, such incredible depth and meaning and beauty to those words. And those words from John are a very familiar reading during Advent. But this morning, we're going to read from a different gospel, from the start of Matthew's gospel, right at the very beginning of the New Testament. These are the words that launch the story of Jesus. And I wonder how many people would vote for this as the best starting lines to a book. If you've got your Bibles, turn to Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1. "This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nahshon. Nahshon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Solomon, the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam, the father of Abijah. Abijah, the father of Asa. Asa, the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat, the father of Joram. Jehoram, the father of Uzziah. Uzziah, the father of Jotham. Jotham, the father of Ahaz. Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh. Manasseh, the father of Amon. Amon, the father of Josiah. And Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon. After the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, the father of Abihud. Abihud, the father of Eliakim. Eliakim, the father of Azor. Azor, the father of Zadok. Zadok, the father of Akim. Akim, the father of Elihud. Elihud, the father of Eleazar. Eleazar, the father of Mathan. Mathan, the father of Jacob. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. Sometimes people decide they're going to read through the New Testament to grow spiritually. Excellent idea. And they open up to this chapter of Matthew because it's right at the very beginning of the whole thing. And they never make it past the first 17 verses. Kind of makes you wonder, what was Matthew thinking? If you're going to write a book, why would he start out with what seems like a cure for insomnia? Well, one reason is that in Israel, they loved genealogies. You didn't have to put yourself, you have to put yourself back in that day where there was no electricity. People didn't go out to the cinema or watch TV or play video games or listen to iPods. At night, people would sit around the fire and tell stories. That's what they did. They loved to do that. And one of their favorite ways of storytelling was to list the names of their ancestors and remember what those people had done. These people knew Torah. They knew the scriptures. And so when they heard the names, they would remember the stories. This gave people a sense of identity and dignity passing from one generation to another. I'm not just a nobody. I'm not just a rootless, illiterate nomad. I'm somebody. Ask me who I am, I'll tell you about my people. To this day in the Middle East, there are tribal nomads who can recite the names of their ancestors going back centuries. It's not unusual for them to go on for more than an hour doing that. Also in Jesus' day, of course, it was an oral culture. For the most part, they didn't have written records, so genealogies were used to establish legal status, financial status, property rights. If you wanted to be a priest, for example, in Jesus' day, you had to be able to show that you were in a line of descendants that went all the way back to Aaron, to the tribe of Levi. So it's not surprising that Matthew would open his book in this way, because Matthew, the book of Matthew, is more than any of the other gospels written for the Jewish people. People would have loved how he's done this. And to establish the identity of the Messiah, this rabbi who spoke with authority, showing people that the Anointed One comes from the right line and was very respectable, was very important. What is surprising, though, are the names that he slips in. Take a guess here. Do you think that an ancient Israelite genealogy would feature the names of men, the fathers, or of women, the mothers? It was the men. Women did not establish bloodlines. They didn't have legal rights in those days. So a reader would start with Matthew's gospel. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, that's all to be expected. Then he says in verse 3, Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. He sticks a woman's name in where a woman's name has no place belonging. And not just any woman. In case you don't remember the story, I'll give you a summary. You can look this up later in Genesis 38. Judah was going to choose a wife for his son, and he went to the Canaanites. He found a Canaanite woman called Tamar. and he married her off to his oldest boy, who was a boy named Ur. Ur, we're told, was put to death because of his immense wickedness. But Judah was obligated to make sure that his daughter-in-law Tamar was taken care of properly, because he took her away from her own people. And he reneges on his promise. He is a covenant breaker to Tamar. She is a woman. She has no legal rights, no idea what to do. So Tamar disguises herself as a cult prostitute. She waits by the side of the road until her father-in-law passes by. It's dark, she's veiled, and he doesn't recognize her. He sleeps with her, and he gives her his staff and his seal as a pledge that he will one day pay her. And then he goes home. A few months later, Judah is told that his widowed daughter-in-law Tamar is pregnant. He gets all self-righteous and says, "Bring her out and have her burned to death before me." The typical form of punishment for someone who was going to be executed in that culture was stoning. Burning was a very severe punishment. Tamar is brought out, but she carries with her Judah's own staff and seal. And she says, "All right, but by the way, before you execute me, just know that I'm pregnant by the man who owns this staff and this seal." You know who owns this staff and this seal? Judah realizes what he's done. He stops the execution and he repents. Now, here's a question for Christine and for Lindsay. In the time that you've been running children's groups, when was the last time you told the story of Tamar, I wonder? Maybe not very recently. Matthew puts Tamar, this woman, into Jesus' story. Daughter-in-law, dressed up like a prostitute, sleeps with her father-in-law, and one of their children, their son, becomes one of the Messiah's ancestors. Matthew writes this in his book. You can imagine Matthew writing his book, and Mrs. Matthew is looking over his shoulder and says, "Matthew, what are you thinking? If you have to put a woman's name in there, for crying out loud, there's Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel and Leah, these great women of faith. Why in the world are you putting Tamar in your book? She's a Canaanite. Her whole story is a disaster. I didn't understand why God put it in Genesis in the first place." But Matthew is writing under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And he says, "Nah, I think I'll just leave Tamar in." And then he goes on. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Here's another woman, Rahab. Another Gentile. She's not an Israelite. She's a pagan. She lives in the city of Jericho. She didn't just dress up like a prostitute. She was a prostitute. That's how she made a living. By the way, you may have noticed that in the Bible there are quite a number of stories about prostitutes. In the ancient world, if a woman was not married and she wasn't under the care of a family, she basically had three choices. She could starve to death, she could beg, or she could be a prostitute. Her house, we're told, was part of the city wall. She was one of those people who, because of what she did, lived on the edge, on the margin, not quite inside, not quite outside. Joshua sends spies to check out Jericho because it's the first city in the promised land that people are going to take. They end up at Rahab's place, and for some reason, something in her was open to God. And she risks her life to protect the Israelite spies. I say to her, "We're coming back, and the city is going to be destroyed. But you gather up your people into this house, and because of your kindness to us, you will be saved." For Matthew's readers, one more time, this is a woman, a Gentile, a scandal. Next line down, Matthew keeps going. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Another woman. Some of you will remember the story of Ruth from when we looked at it over the summer. There was a woman named Naomi. she and her husband lived in Bethlehem, but there was a famine in the land. So they took their two sons and went to another country called Moab. Both their sons were married there, but they then died. Her husband died. Naomi was devastated. She decides to return to Israel, but her two daughters-in-law were from Moab. So she says to them, stay in Moab, find a husband here amongst your own people and remarry. And one of them does remain behind, a woman called Orpah. But the other daughter-in-law was Ruth. And Ruth is the one that said those fabulous words to her mother-in-law. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. It is a beautiful story. There's something else you remember about Ruth. Ruth was not just a Gentile. She was a Moabite. According to Genesis 19:37, the Moabites were the product of an incestuous relationship between Lot and one of his daughters. It's a horrible story. Moabites were considered by the Israelites to be so unclean that the law had said, no Moabite or any of his descendants may enter your assembly, may be a part of your community, even down to the 10th generation. Ruth is a Moabite. Matthew says, I'll put her in the story. That means that the line leading to the Messiah includes Moabite blood. Matthew's not done yet. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Anyone remember the name of Uriah's wife? Bathsheba. Bathsheba was her name. That's a pretty sordid story. Matthew, you notice, doesn't even mention her by name. He says Uriah's wife. He wants to make sure that everybody remembers. He could have said anything about David. He could have said, David, a man after God's own heart. He could have said, David, who wrote the Psalms. He could have said, David, who slew Goliath. He doesn't. The David that Matthew describes is David who committed adultery with Uriah's wife and then killed him. Uriah was known as Uriah the Hittite, which means Bathsheba was a Gentile by marriage. Matthew deliberately sticks this in. He starts out the story of Jesus with a genealogy. Great way to start. Great idea. But he keeps throwing in these names where they don't belong. Women. Pagan. Scandal. Matthew, what are you thinking? Don't you know what a genealogy is supposed to do? Ask me who I am, I'll tell you about my people. I'll tell you what Matthew was thinking. Matthew is saying, this is a record of the people of Jesus Christ. Only get ready for a little surprise. Because the people that Jesus Christ is going to identify with and love and let into his kingdom are not going to look like what everyone has been expecting them to look like. Things are going to get a little scandalous now. It's not going to be respectable. This is the gospel before the gospel. This is Matthew saying, now with Jesus coming, anybody who wants to get in is going to get in. Because Jesus just wants everybody. He just wants everybody to come in. Martin Luther said about this passage, it is as though God intended for people to hear this genealogy and to say to themselves, oh, Christ is the kind of person who is not ashamed of sinners. See, he even puts them in his family tree. So if anybody here this morning is tempted to think, I've messed up too much, my sin is too dark, God cannot use someone who's done what I've done, I think Jesus would say to you this morning, are you kidding? Look at my family. You have no idea what I can do if you just open up your eyes to me. Jesus embodied this so deeply that he came to be called friend of sinners. Matthew tells us that. And we sometimes think about that phrase as a compliment. Isn't Jesus great? He's the friend of sinners. Well, let's be clear. In those days, that was an accusation. That was a charge. Matthew is tipping us off. This Messiah, this rabbi, will get in a lot of trouble over those friendships. People read this genealogy of Jesus, and when they start following him, they begin to have a heart like his heart for people who are far from God. They just start wanting everybody to come in. Time's getting on a bit, but I want to finish with a story by Tony Campolo. You may know his name. He's a sociologist. And you may have heard this story before, but it's like it was written just for this passage. So I really want to read it today. Tony was in Hawaii one time, and he describes how he got up really early one morning feeling hungry because of the time change. It was about 3:30 in the morning when he found his way to a diner. He's at the diner, and the door of the diner suddenly swings open. And to my discomfort, he writes, in marched 8 or 9 provocative and boisterous prostitutes. It was a small place, and they sat on either side of me. Their talk was loud and crude. I felt completely out of place and was just about to make my getaway when I overheard the woman sitting next to me saying, tomorrow is my birthday. I'm going to be 39. Her friend responded in a nasty tone, so what do you want from me? Birthday party? What do you want? Want me to get you a cake and sing happy birthday? Come on, the woman sitting next to me said. I was just telling you it's my birthday. I don't want anything from you. I never had a birthday party in my whole life. Why should I have one now? Tony writes, when I heard that, I made a decision. I sat and waited until the woman left. Then I called to the guy behind the counter. I said to him, do they come in here every night?
Yeah.
That one right beside me, does she come in here every night?
Yeah, he said. That's Agnes. She comes here every night. Why do you want to know?
Because I heard her say tomorrow's her birthday, I told him. What do you say you and I do something about that? What do you think about us throwing a birthday party for her right here tomorrow night? The guy loved the idea. He told his wife. She said, that's wonderful. Agnes is one of those people who is really kind and nice, and nobody ever does anything nice and kind for her. Look, I said, if it's okay with you, I'll come back tomorrow morning about 2:30 and decorate the place. I'll even get a birthday cake. No way, said Harry. That was his name. The birthday cake's my thing. I'll make the cake. At 2:30 the next morning, I was back at the diner. I'd picked up crepe paper, decorations, made a sign on a big piece of cardboard that read, Happy Birthday, Agnes. I decorated that diner from one end to the other. I had that diner looking good. The woman who did the cooking must have gotten the word out on the street, because by 3:15, every prostitute in Honolulu was in the place. There were wall-to-wall prostitutes and me. At 3:30, on the dot, the door of the diner swung open, and in came Agnes and her friend. I had everybody ready, and when they all came in, we screamed, Happy Birthday! Never have I seen a person so flabbergasted, so shaken. Her mouth fell open. Her legs buckled. Her friend grabbed her arm to steady her. As she was led to one of the stools by the counter, we all sang Happy Birthday to her. When we came to the end of our singing, Happy Birthday, dear Agnes, Happy Birthday to you, her eyes moistened. Then when the birthday cake with all the candles on it was carried out, she lost it, just openly cried. Harry gruffly mumbled, blow out the candles, Agnes. Come on, blow out the candles. If you don't blow out the candles, I'm going to have to blow out the candles. After a few endless seconds, he did. Then he handed her a knife. Cut the cake, Agnes. Yo, Agnes, we all want some cake. Agnes looked down at the cake.
Then without taking her eyes off it, she slowly and softly said, "Look, Harry, is it all right if what I want to ask is it okay if I keep the cake a little while? I mean, is it all right if I don't eat it right away?" Harry shrugged. "Sure, it's okay. If you want to keep the cake, keep the cake. You can take it home if you want." "Can I?" she asked. And looking at me, she said, "I live just down the street a couple of doors. I want to take the cake home, all right? I'll be right back, honest." She got off the stool, picked up that cake, carrying it like it was the Holy Grail, and walked slowly towards the door. As we all just stood there motionless, she left. When the door closed, there was a stunned silence in the place. Not knowing what else to do, I broke the silence by saying, "What do you say we pray?" Looking back on it now, it seems a little strange to be leading a prayer meeting with a bunch of prostitutes in a diner in Honolulu at 3:30 in the morning. But then it just felt like the right thing to do. I prayed for Agnes. I prayed for her salvation. I prayed that her life would be changed. I prayed that God would be good to her. When I finished, Harry leaned over the counter, and with a trace of hostility in his voice, he said, "Hey, you never told me you were a preacher. What kind of church do you belong to?" In one of those moments when just the right words come, I answered, "I belong to a church that throws birthday parties for prostitutes at 3:30 in the morning." Harry paused a moment, then almost sneered as he answered, "No, you don't. There's no church like that. If there was, I'd join it. I'd join a church like that."